Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Town, and Gene DiNardo. Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, we're talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-hosts Jake Town and Gene DiNardo. It is Thursday, March 8th, 2012. Here are some of the headlines we're following today. Super Tuesday, we're going to go over the results and what the delegate updates might actually look like. We're going to take a look at International Women's Day and what are the various things to celebrate there. We're going to look at the possibility that world poverty, at least extreme world poverty, might be on the decline. We're also going to look at what the environmental damages continue to be after the BP deal. But the first story we're going to follow this week is a story coming out of Greece. Greece has basically announced today, they're going to make the official announcement tomorrow, that they have reached their target of over 75% participation in the debt swap, debt write-down deal. And, of course, they're going to be trumpeting this for quite some time as having cut the Greece national sovereign debt by over 100 billion euros, I believe, is what the final figure is going to be, although it should be pointed out, this isn't really cutting debt. This is more along the lines of, like, writing it off and saying to the people who loaned the money, well, too bad, guys. You just lost half of what your investment was.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to cut the interest rate on the one-year Greek bond, which was at 1,006% the last time I looked at it. What a return.
Yeah, let's see, 1,006% on a bond where you've lost more than half of the value of the bond and you have no guarantee that you're going to get that return. How does that one add up?
Maybe you'll get a couple cents out of it.
Maybe they'll even get some common sense out of it. You never really know. Of course, the real question is this the end of the borrowing? Because as we have described a few times here on the show, maybe like every week, the situation with the Greek budget is really not all that under control. I mean, they've been aiming at hitting the targets that they agreed to hit in conjunction with their negotiations with the European Central Bank and the other European countries. But that target still puts them at 20% over their GDP in terms of total of borrowing. So it makes me wonder, yeah, how stable is this solution really going to be? And, of course, that continues to bother the markets, doesn't it, Jake?
Oh, yeah.
This is something that's not going to be going away anytime soon. In conjunction with this, now the stock market was up today. The precious metals markets were also up, so there is some positive motion in that direction. And yet this kind of offset what was coming out with unemployment numbers, and we'll be going into that a little bit later too. But the sort of not-so-good news that came in with unemployment kind of got dampened by what's going on in Greece. So it looks like the markets are kind of getting euphoric about it. But I think we'll see in the next weeks and months ahead that euphoria is rather short-lived. Meanwhile, we just passed Super Tuesday, which got not as much attention as one might have thought. I mean, people were paying attention, but not really paying attention. And, Jake, nothing was really resolved out of it, was it?
Well, I guess the biggest story out of it, right after Super Tuesday, Mitt Romney won the popular vote in 6 out of the 10 states. Santorum took 3 states, and Gingrich took his home state of Georgia, so leaving Ron Paul the only one to not finish with a win, although I think he finished second in three of the states. But I would say the main takeaway is that Mitt Romney did not win a crushing victory, which means that the delegate count is really, it's going to be very difficult for him to get to 1,144 bound delegates before the Republican convention, I think in Tampa later on this year before the election. So, and it's, the Romney campaign was very quick to come out saying that that they had won and, all the other guys should drop out. But I would say just because of, how things went, I think all the other three candidates, there's no way that they're going to pull out anytime soon. Santorum has had kind of a very unexpected level of success. He'll continue to run. He's looked at a lot of times as the runner-up. Gingrich doesn't really take a whole lot to feed his ego, and winning in Georgia will give him some hope for winning the rest of the southern states. If he had not won in Georgia, it's probably likely that he would have heavily considered dropping out. And Ron Paul is staying, you know, he's just after the delegates, because what he's been saying is that, which is completely the truth, it doesn't really matter who wins the straw poll in a lot of states. Like, sometimes the straw poll determines where these delegates go for the Republican Party. But the latest that I've seen out of Reality Check on Fox News is that Romney has only locked up, now the Associated Press is reporting he has 415, which is a little bit over a third of what he needs, but the bound delegates that he has is at least 244. So he really doesn't have anywhere near the magic number, even though we're about halfway through the primary season. Santorum has a lot of, not a whole lot of organization in a lot of states, because he didn't have a lot of funding and fundraising coming into this. So a lot of the popular vote that he has is ending up being wasted. But the number of delegates that he's reported as having is 176, but the number of bound delegates that he has that must vote for him at the convention is only 17. Gingrich has 52 bound delegates, although the Associated Press is reporting 105, and Ron Paul has more than 11 bound delegates, although the Associated Press is reporting him in distant fourth place at 47. But the big story is there already is at least 197 unbound delegates, and what that means is they can really vote however they so choose. So the big thing is, and a lot of these delegates don't get chosen on the state level until the state convention later on. So, you know, it's a pretty wide open race, I would say. You know, Mitt Romney certainly is the front runner. But all the signs are, and I would say it's higher than 50-50, is that there's going to be a brokered convention, and that most likely it'll even go past, and then when you get to that, it's, you know, does it go past the first vote or not? Because if it goes past the first vote, then all of the delegates become unbound and they can vote for whoever they want. So it could be quite a show for the Republican Party, just and this convention will be just a few months before the November election.
And if you went into the convention with theoretically maybe 700-800 delegates, that's a lot of work to do to get to 1125 or 1150. That could be an interesting convention.
Well, yeah, and remember too, after the first vote, they're all unbound. So who's ever, even if they are all bound for Romney and something comes up, they certainly don't have to vote for him in the succeeding vote. So it's kind of a wide open race. I think that, you know, the preference for the three of us is Ron Paul is probably still a distant fourth. But it's kind of unknown where the delegates are, and that's what his campaign keeps saying, that they're, you know, they're just after the delegates. What is possible is that, or what is looking pretty fairly likely, is that he would be able to have some type of influence when this person is chosen, because his delegates could go kind of, you know, where they will, whereas kind of what the nation is finding out with different candidates winning everywhere is that no one really likes, I would say, any of the four Republican candidates. None of them are really showing themselves to be head and shoulders above the rest.
It brings up a good point, is where exactly would Ron Paul's delegates go if they had to choose somebody other than Ron Paul?
Well, it's interesting that you raised that question, because within the past hour, the Paul campaign put out an email to its supporters, and the email was entitled, My Status as a Candidate. Let me just read the first part of the email to you. Dear Liberty Activists, the mainstream media got the Super Tuesday story wrong, very wrong, again. I'm sure you heard them gleefully talk about which establishment candidate won which primary or caucus Tuesday night, if you were even watching. most Americans, thankfully, had more sense and switched on something else. The fact is, just like in many of the earlier contests, very few delegates to the Republican National Convention were decided on Tuesday. Most will be decided several weeks or even months from now at district and state conventions, conventions where our local delegates will have a big say in who goes to Tampa. In fact, while I didn't win any state's straw polls, my team expects me to win a plurality of delegates in at least three states, as well as outright majorities in two more of the states that have already started their process. Of course, the media totally ignores this story, as they have consistently ignored our message, our passion, and our grassroots army. Even more lost in the shuffle is that no candidate for president has even made it one-third of the way toward the number of delegates needed to win the nomination. And for that reason, I am determined to proudly battle on, picking up more delegates and skewering the pretensions and historical rewrites of all the establishment candidates: Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, and Newt Gingrich. So he's basically not only just mirroring what you just said, Jake, but he's going a step forward. He's saying a step further than where you went. He's saying he's actually putting a strong delegate showing together. This could get even more interesting than perhaps we thought 5 minutes ago.
Right, and just for our audience, like what they're saying is absolutely correct. Like I'll use every state is different, but I'll use Pennsylvania as an example. Each county in Pennsylvania sends three delegates to Harrisburg, and then Harrisburg then selects, I think it's just 10 people to go to Tampa. But three of them are just the Republican chairman and the vice chair. The other seven are chosen by the remaining delegates. But it's very tricky because the delegates don't have, like when you go in to vote, like I actually don't even know what the ballot looks like at this point. But the delegates are the only ones that actually matter, and the delegates don't have like the person's name next to them. So if the campaign is not organized enough to turn out the vote, and they don't know who's on the ballot that will be the delegate that's going to represent them, chances are very likely that it's going to go to someone that or they just won't vote for the delegate thing, because in Pennsylvania the straw poll does not matter. The straw vote doesn't matter at all. It doesn't matter who wins, literally. So each state is different, but it's very unclear, and I think that kind of highlighting like the media is kind of putting Romney out there as the front runner, and I'd have to say, because he's won a decent amount of bound delegates, the number that I gave him, 244 of bound, some of those bound delegates, when they go to Tampa, are going to be wanting to vote for one of the other three on the second vote, if it goes to a second vote. And at this point, I'd say it's better than 50-50 that this is a brokered convention.
This is going to be quite something to watch, because clearly the average American has no clue about how the Republican process works. They don't even have a clue that there could be some serious deviation from what happens in the actual votes in the primaries and caucuses. When that comes out, when people start realizing that, I have to think that actually hurts the Republican Party. I mean, I don't see how that helps them, because the basic sense that's going to come out of it is that the Republican Party leadership is going to be perceived as having skewered their own primaries.
Yes, and, on top of that, the more indecision goes kind of gives the incumbent, President Obama, more and more time to solidify and just focus on bodily moving voters to the polls in November. They literally really won't have to worry about, the attacking side until the Republicans bloody themselves up at the convention.
Yeah, that's a good point, and they are bloodying themselves up. They're tending to make more extreme statements. I think the recent example is what they've been saying on Syria and stuff like that, and it just makes it easy for Obama to sit back and say something that would relate to more the average American person, who may not want us to fly into another war, or similar comments like that. And I don't see it as being good for the Republican side, and I think that's why the main party chiefs are pushing towards Romney, not so much because they think he's a great guy and a great candidate, but just to try to solidify the party.
One of the other countries around the world that is also dealing with elections this year just actually completed an election. Russia reelected Vladimir Putin as their, I guess they call him president. I believe that's what the office is. And it was a rather contentious election with quite a bit of fallout. Jake, what are the details on that?
Right. And again, just for some past history, Putin has kind of moved from prime minister to president and in order to get around constitutional limits. And by doing that, he has kind of maintained control over that, because when he was prime minister was the biggest role. Now he's president. President is the biggest role. So the report is that he won with about 64% of the vote. According to the official data, he was given a clear advantage over the rivals by the media and the state resources, since the media is still owned by the state. So he was able to turn out. There was a very large multi-thousand people protests in Moscow and other major cities, just, I would say, more or less just against Putin. But there's been a lot of charges of ballot box stuffing. There's even a video been circulating around. The Austrian, one of the observers of it that I was just reading, an Austrian parliament member, reported back that the bias that is there is actually just political bias, and he said that the observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and the Council of Europe's Parliamentary Assembly have called that the alleged electoral violations to be thoroughly investigated. In other words, saying that the election was kind of rigged. This MP is saying that he doesn't feel he's even at the same election as they were, and he goes on to state that, quote, it appears to be politically motivated action. The U.S. CE probably wrote the report released after the election, before the election even occurred. This is what he was telling to Reuters. And he goes on to talk about how the OSCE is a very political organization, mainly controlled by the EU. So kind of, I'm not going to say, obviously I wasn't there exactly how this election went. Certainly it's contentious on either side. Certainly having Putin in power, there is a very vocal group that does not want him in power, but he will remain there.
It was also interesting to notice how many international observers and how many other countries questioned the results coming out of the Russian elections, because they actually got quite a bit of heat from a lot of places around the world about them.
Yes, and it's, when you take a look at hot spots like Iran, for instance, one of the allies, if something would go wrong, well, anywhere really in the Middle East, Syria is also getting pretty hot. Russia and also China would be kind of on the, if they were to show up, would be on the anti-U.S. Side. Mainly to protect their borders and their security. And this has kind of gone back for really through the Cold War even. And I think that that's kind of a part here, because plays a big part, because the more dissent and the more divided Russia is, and the more Putin kind of has to, a former KGB officer kind of needs to focus on keeping his own population controlled. I think in the minds of the world leaders, it gives them less time to kind of act internationally and other borders.
And of course, international leaders are focused mainly on the financial situation, as well as what goes on with Iran and the oil situation. But one thing that's always in the back of everyone's mind is what happens with the poorest of the poor around the world. And Gene, you have some interesting details about the possibility that perhaps we're seeing a bit of a reversal in that area.
Yeah, which was completely unexpected. Of course, this article is based on a World Bank report, so we have to take that into consideration.
We'll have this huge canister of salt that we'll throw, okay?
Yes. World Bank report shows a broad-based reduction in extreme poverty. This is for the entire world, and indicates that the global recession, contrary to economists' expectations, did not increase poverty in the developing world. The report shows that for the first time, the proportion of people living in extreme poverty, which they consider less than $1.25 a day, fell in every developing region between 2005 and 2008. You know, that's kind of an interesting thing. They pick $1.25 a day, which can buy you just incredible. I mean, that's not much anywhere, but it buys you a lot more, say, in a country like Mexico than in a country like Sweden. And it goes on to say that the biggest recession since the Great Depression seems not to have thrown that trend off course. Preliminary data from 2010 indicates the progress is so dramatic that the world has met the United Nations Millennium Development Goals to cut extreme poverty in half 5 years before its 2015 deadline. There's a couple comments that say it's, of course, very good news. The report also indicates that despite the world entering a recession in 2009, poverty did not increase in developing nations, and it's basically the proportion of people in the developing world where extreme poverty declined, and they said it's fundamentally because of strong growth in countries such as Brazil, India, and especially China, growth that helped buoy economies in Africa and South America. So most of the growth is in these extremely low-wage or no-wage countries, and most of the fast growth, and this is just what's happening. Despite the fact that there's still a lot of poverty, people are being lifted above it by just the fact that they have a job where they didn't have one before, and it is good news. You know, it's still an economy that's out of sync and not a just economy, but that's always good news when poverty is decreasing.
If it is indeed decreasing, and I think
you
brought the right point on that, because first of all, the fact that the World Bank puts this out is always, you know, gives us room for concern, to say the least.
Well, I agree, because if you think about it, that would kind of signify the fact that poverty is decreasing, that the World Bank is doing its job. I mean, it's, you know, the whole purpose. They claim their purpose is to, spread the economic cream or around the world, and, you know, by loaning money here, distributing money there, and we kind of talked about what their actual purpose is. So yeah, that's kind of a jaded report if it's coming from them. I would think they would want to see poverty to decrease.
We should also point out, though, that as you mentioned, they're trying to base it on whether or not someone is living on $1.25 a day, and it really isn't so important what the dollar amount is. What matters is what the cost of living in that country is.
Yes, if you're in...
So that doesn't really tell us anything about what the cost of living is in any of the particular countries. I mean,
yeah, to put that figure on the entire world and then do a study, I mean, it just seems random, because it isn't much anywhere. $1.25
no.
is what, 400, no. you know, four... 450 bucks a year, but
that's not the point. The point is, if we're trying to measure whether or not poverty is decreasing, we have to have it against an objective measure that
right.
fits that country.
Exactly. So if you've got $1.25 in Guatemala and $1.25 in a country in Africa, you probably have a completely, maybe double the purchasing power, say, in the African country. So it's, that doesn't make much sense.
Yeah, if you have a small number of people who are living on $1.25 a day, but the inflation in that country has taken off, well, they're probably even more in poverty than they were before. But since you measured it funny, you got a bad reading out of it.
Yeah, so if you take it yesterday, maybe you're okay.
Yeah.
Tomorrow doesn't
kind of
work.
Scary when you think about it, but yeah, exactly. But anyway, thank you for that report.
I thought the World Bank was doing a great job in Africa over the past 50 or 60 years. I mean, you know, aren't they like the next, greatest place to live on Earth?
Well, it's the poster child for, you know, central banking.
Yeah, no, very sarcastic, of course. I mean, I think that both the World Bank and the IMF has completely failed and really serve no purpose in terms of humanitarian type things. I think that really the things that they've imposed is really kind of more suited, like you were saying, for like the central banks or sovereign nations' interests than the interests of the people that actually live in these countries.
You know, Africa is an interesting point, because whenever you're having a discussion with anybody defending the existing financial system and the central banking system and fiat monetary system, if you bring up nobody, none of them want to talk about Africa. if this system is so good, all you have to say is, this system is so good, how about Africa? What's the problem? Because, you know, they're always bringing up countries, Central America, and, oh, look at, you know, how they're improving and blah, blah, blah. But you mention Africa, and it's a stumper.
The one thing that I should point out, though, that we should point out, is Africa has actually had certain improvement in certain countries. I mean, we don't want to draw necessarily a broad sweeping statement that says that all of Africa is suffering, because it isn't necessarily true.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But you have to look, you have to pinpoint very specific areas to find that. It's not going to be a general trend across all countries across the continent. Meanwhile, International Women's Day is upon us. Jake, you've been doing some research on that and come up with some very interesting points about what there is to celebrate about International Women's Day this year.
Yes, and International Women's Day, I didn't even know this existed. It's been around for about 100 years. It's not really highly celebrated in the United States as it probably should be. The first time I'd ever heard of it, I was working as an engineer over in Shanghai, and over there in China, it's actually a major holiday. And I think all the women at the factory where I was at got to go home. They only got like a half day, and the guys had to stay around and work the rest of the day. So I was like, huh, it's kind of interesting. But the world does celebrate over 100 years of International Women's Day. Obviously, women have made many strides towards equality from kind of the male-dominated society of the 1800s and really the 1900s. But reading off of a column out of all places, Fox News, it's very skeptical of the progress that women have made. You know, and if you just take a look at the Republican candidates, especially like Rick Santorum, who has very extreme positions on abortion and other social issues that are very anti-choice, and a lot of people would even argue anti-women, because especially on abortion. Then you have commentator Rush Limbaugh calling a female law student a prostitute and a slut, while not even knowing who she was. And I went back and actually saw this footage. I was just in shock at the things that were coming out of this guy's mouth. And, you know, he, for better or for worse, and I think it's definitely for worse, he's a mainstream political commentator.
Well apparently, and his advertisers also were kind of in shock, because a lot of them have been pulling out.
Yeah, it was just a whole bunch of filth, so it's very good to see that happening. And she goes through some of the other statistics that in America, women are more likely to be in poverty than men. Although women make up about 50% of the workforce, which is surprising to me that there would be about 50%, they occupy less than 14% of the board seats in Fortune 500 companies, and only 10% in public companies. The representation of women and the American government continues to be extremely low. Women hold 17% of Senate seats and 17% of seats in the House of Representatives. There are only 6 women governors, so what's that, 12%. The United States ranks number 69 in the world in terms of female representation in national legislatures. So that ties us with Turkmenistan, of all countries. So pretty much all of Europe, rest of the civilized world is kind of ahead of us, and we're stuck down with a lot of these male-dominated cultures, which is kind of a surprising way to look at things. And I think that, you know, certainly women have made strides, but I think that there's a lot more strides that they have to do, or that they can do. And I think some of the interesting stories that are out there, like Forbes just came out with its billionaire list. And the newest billionaire also happens to be the youngest woman to get onto the billionaires list without help from a husband or an inheritance. Her name is Sarah Blakely, and she is the founder and inventor, really, of Spanx, which is kind of kind of converted pantyhose for the midriff section, that sort of like the 21st century version of the girdle to kind of work on the figure for women. And she started off with $5,000. And while she was working another job, she put this together. She wrote her own patent from a book that she got found in a Barnes and Nobles, and kind of got going. And her holding in the company is valued at over $1 billion, which is amazing. And I think she's only 41 years of age. She's been doing it for about a decade. Another female billionaire, her name is Judy Faulkner, and I'm not listing people like Meg Whitman of eBay fame, or others. One of the, I think, co-founders of Facebook is also female, but this one has a very interesting niche company. She is the founder and CEO of Epic Systems, which sells electronic health records. So they might be getting government funding for all I know. But she is in the very tiny town of Verona, Wisconsin, stays away from the press, rarely gives interviews, but her share in the company and holdings are estimated over just over $1 billion. So just two of the women out there that have gone, and at least on one of the things where you can measure the success, dollars or ounces of gold, however you want to look at it, they've been very successful.
Yeah, there's still these strongholds of male dominance. It's funny because I went to I'd never been to a golf tournament, and went to one a few months ago, and it was interesting. It was fun, but they have a little comedy hour or so before the tournament, and the comments and just the whole atmosphere, I thought it was the 1950s. It was unbelievable. And you know, they were doing things that if you did in an office, or saying things I should say, that would be you know, you'd end up in court. And it was really interesting to see. And you know, everybody just took it as the normal course of events. Of course, it was probably 80. It's those things are still, you know, 70-80% male, but it's still out there.
Well,
gas rush.
Good news overall for the International Women's Day and the hopes of women everywhere. And we're a little bit past the half hour, so we'll take a quick break. After the break, we'll come back and we'll talk about that funny metal that Jake talked about, the one that Ben Bernanke tells us is not money, gold, because there are a couple of interesting stories about that. Plus, we're also going to take a look at what might be happening with the breakup of Anonymous, the hacker group that basically found they have a mole amidst their ranks and has caused quite a bit of consternation within that circle. And we'll also take a look at what's been going on with the cost of college education since the early 1980s. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And just a reminder, you can always check out our archives on PRN.FM, or you can check them out at our website, www.freedomnewshour.com. And here's a little hint for you. You might want to check it out to see who our guest is going to be next week. It's going to be an interesting show. I won't even give you any details. Just send you to the website. Meanwhile, we were talking about gold before the break there, and there's a couple interesting pieces of information that have come out. First, we're going to go to Jake for something he dug up about what's going on in Germany and Switzerland.
Yes, over in the EU, or I guess Switzerland is outside of the EU, but geographically right in the middle of it, the countries of Germany and Switzerland, are the people there are kind of getting nervous about whether their countries are having their own gold or not. And while here in the United States there was Congressman Ron Paul had a gold audit hearing, kind of almost a lone wolf in the wilderness type deal. I haven't seen anything kind of come out of that, although they did point out that there was a lot of holes in the auditing procedures that did come out during the congressional testimony, namely that they aren't even checking the bars. of cold to see if they're physically there. In the case of Germany, it's highly rumored that they've engaged in gold swaps with the United States or other sovereign nations or bullion banks, which are pretty much they might keep the gold in a certain location, but the rest of it is then given to the other party, which sells it at market price or does whatever they so wish with it. In Germany, the actual German Federal Audit Office has criticized its central bank. So this is the Germans' political body that does audits has criticized the German central bank's lax auditing and inventory controls regarding Germany's sizable gold reserves, which is about 3,400 metric tons of gold, which is one of the largest, if not number two, holder of gold in the world after the United States, which has about claims to have about 8,000 tons. They're stating that there is increasing nervousness amongst the German public, German politicians, and even the central bank itself regarding the recent expansion of the European Central Bank, the ECB, which had its balance sheet surge to a record 3.02 trillion euros just very recently with these LTRO operations, which we talked about on past shows. It's their balance sheet has shot up a trillion euros of, you know, pretty much just money being lent to the banks for 3 years at very negligible interest costs, which we all know is going to result in inflation sooner rather than later. And they go on to state that Germany really hasn't had a proper audit in the three-year time period. So even the time period has elapsed, and they have not done the required audits of it. It's believed that at least 60% of Germany's gold is stored outside of Germany. Much of it is believed to be at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which just kind of keeps popping up everywhere. And in Switzerland, four parliament members have put together a proposal. And, you know, again, we do have these proposals in the United States, but they're pretty much proposed by one person in both the House and the Senate, and their last names is both Paul. And the proposal is to collect 100,000 signatures of Swiss citizens to place onto a national ballot on a national initiative, which should stipulate that the gold of the Swiss National Bank, their central bank, must be stored physically in Switzerland, that the Swiss National Bank does not have the right to sell its gold reserves, and that the Swiss National Bank must hold at least 20% of its total assets in gold. So that would kind of constrain the central bank from monetary expansion. So this is a very interesting procedure. We'll be watching to see where it goes. I kind of suspect it won't go anywhere, but you know, the fact that four members of the Swiss Parliament are coming out, I think it just kind of underscores how nervous they're starting to get over in Europe, since they're kind of getting their version of our 2008 banker bailout over there.
It's certainly true, and providing some circumstantial evidence to support many of the assertions you made in your report from Reuters, the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China Limited, which Reuters describes as the world's most valuable lender, that's their words, said in a statement that its gold leasing business reached 62.8 tons of physical metal in 2011. The bank, which started gold leasing in January last year, has more than 100 clients, including jewelers, industrial users, refiners, and miners, who borrow gold for up to a year. The bank charges a fee for the leased gold, which is returned within an agreed time period. Notice how they don't mention anything about banks. That's the one thing that really caught my attention when I read this article. It also says that the country's gold output in 2011 rose 5.89% from the year before to 360.95 metric tons. So kind of reinforcing what you were suggesting, that gold is being borrowed or leased from a variety of different sources, and quite possibly it sounds like one of those sources might be the Industrial and Commercial Bank of China. Meanwhile, we also have news of what's been happening as a result of not having gold from a variety of different reports coming out, including one that Gene dug up about what's been happening with the cost of college education. Gene, just how much has it risen since the 1980s?
It's incredible. Between 1982 and 2007, the cost of a college education increased 439%. It's almost unbelievable. And that was this is again an article from PolitiFact Check, and the comment was from one of our, I believe he's a congressman, is Ron Wyden. So they're checking into it, and it just seems like it cannot possibly be true. But they went to where the figures originally came from, and that was a 2008 study by the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education, a respected and nonpartisan think tank that dives deeply into funding and cost and effectiveness of colleges. And there on page 8, there's a graph that shows the cost of tuition and fees soaring 439% between the years of 82 and 2007. That increase obviously far outstrips the rise in costs for such things, even as health care, which we've talked about. It's gone up so incredibly faster than the rate of inflation, and the increase in medium income. Darcy Harvey, a policy analyst for the center, said the results were based on government data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, which compiles the Consumer Price Index. Well, that's got to take that one with a grain of salt. That index is the federal government's official measure for the direction of prices, as opposed to their unofficial one. If you adjust for inflation, the increase for tuition and fees from 1980 to 2007 is even higher, 455%, according to the same data. Let's see this quote. Let me read this quote first. See, it's by first. College tuition continues to outpace family income, obviously, and the price of other necessities such as medical care, food, and housing. That's from the same study. Whatever the causes of these tuition increases, a continuation of trends of the last quarter century would place higher education beyond the reach of most Americans and would greatly exacerbate the debt burdens of those who do enroll. I don't know if that is probably has already happened for most people. The National Center for Education Statistics, quote from them, is between 1999 and 2000, and between 2009 and 2010, prices for undergraduate tuition, room, and board at public institutions rose 37%, and prices at private institutions rose 25%. That's after adjustment for inflation. It probably rose less for private institutions because they were already so high at private institutions. A recent report from the College Board, the same people who bring you the SAT test, and also monitor college costs and student aid, found that between 2006 and 7 and 2011 and 2012, average tuition and fees at public four-year colleges and universities increased annually an average of 5.1% above inflation. The U.S. Department of Education, now Center for Education, goes even deeper. They say in 91 and 92 school year, annual tuition and fees at four-year public universities on average were $2,107. They climbed to $8,244 in 2011 and 2012, an increase of about 291%. And it goes on, and no matter how you cut it, the cost of college is just phenomenal now. I mean, you kind of wonder, I think people should take a good look at it and say, is it really worth it? What do you get out of it for, you know, 4 years of tuition at a private institution easily is $100,000? You could start a pretty good business with that.
It's a very good point, and one of the things that goes along with it is the fact that there is developing and building a new possibility of large-scale default on existing student loans because of the employment picture, among other things, and because of the state of the economy. In fact, tomorrow we're expecting the next round of Bureau of Labor Statistics employment numbers, which are expected to be reported being an increase of about 200,000 jobs. But pick up an interesting article from the New York Post. This is by a gentleman named John Crudell, and he has done quite a bit of reporting in the past for the Post about the unemployment numbers. Let me just read a few paragraphs from this. This appeared in their paper yesterday. He says, when Americans were asked recently about the most basic economic issue, if they were having trouble putting food on the table, 18.6% said yes, they were. That was the highest percentage since the financial crisis began 4 years ago. I'm mentioning that survey, he says, because tomorrow is when the Labor Department reports how many jobs the economy supposedly created in February. Statistics, especially when only taken at their face value, tend to hide what's really going on. So let's go through the numbers first so you will not be bamboozled by Labor's jobs report or Wall Street's reaction to it. The experts think Labor will report that the economy created 206,000 new jobs in February. That guess might have even climbed a bit since yesterday, that would have been Tuesday, when the ADP National Employment Report, which monitors payroll taxes to determine who just got a private sector job, said companies created 216,000 jobs last month, and that was slightly higher than the experts were predicting. The difference between ADP and Labor's report is that ADP doesn't count government jobs. Labor's figures, as I've been telling you for years, he says, don't give a very good depiction of what is going on in the economy at a particular moment in time. The department won't argue with that statement, and that's why Labor adjusts and adjusts and adjusts its statistics. Only after those tweaks do you get a very clear idea of what the economy was doing 2 years ago. Government statisticians would contend that it isn't their fault that Wall Street has the urge to trade billions of dollars of stocks and bonds before the employment numbers are completely polished. How do I know they'd say that? Because government economists in Washington have said this to me many times, he writes. Take just a single example. Labor's report in early February, it showed that 243,000 new jobs were created in January. The only problem was that the number wasn't true. The pure, undoctored, not seasonally adjusted figures showed there was really a loss of 2.689 million jobs.
Unbelievable.
There is always a loss of jobs after the Christmas season, and any professional in the financial industry who doesn't know that needs to get into another line of work. As I've reported before, the 2.689 million job loss turned into a gain of 243,000 only because Labor's seasonal adjustment programs expected the job losses to be bigger.
It's the same thing they do with the budget.
The warm winter weather probably kept some people from being put out of work, and this threw off Washington's calculations. Will that same thing happen with tomorrow's number? That isn't likely. Yes, the weather has remained warm, but Labor's computers are expecting undoctored, not seasonally adjusted growth of more than 800,000 jobs in February. So there's less chance that the seasonal adjustments will be pleasantly surprising. And February isn't one of those months in which Washington includes a huge guesstimate for jobs added by companies it thinks but can't prove were just started. This so-called birth-death model has been the biggest contributor to job growth, bogus job growth, over the past few years. Stock prices fell sharply on Tuesday for a variety of reasons, but the most important was concern over the U.S. economy. After the January employment report, commentators started spewing nonsense that despite a high 8.3% unemployment rate and sharply rising gasoline prices, voters were suddenly okay with the economy. And it goes on and on. But I thought, wow, that's one of the most poignant articles on unemployment I've read in a long, long time.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's an investment firm, TrimTabs Investment Research, and they publish their own figures on the number of jobs added or lost. And the interesting thing about what they do is that they estimate it based on analysis of the daily income tax deposits to the U.S. Treasury from all salaried U.S. employees. Stating that historically they're more accurate than the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, and they're estimating that the U.S. economy added 149,000 jobs in February, which is down from January's estimate of 181,000, which they state isn't like the worst thing in the world, because at least it's not like an overall job loss, but it's nothing special, and that they need at least a quarter million a month to have anywhere near a chance of actually adding more to outpace the population growth.
Isn't it interesting how that always gets lost in the shuffle? They never actually include that in any of the reports, do they?
No, absolutely not.
Go ahead, Jake.
Oh, sorry, Gene. Also, with the gasoline prices going up as much as 40 to 80 cents per gallon, that's equivalent to roughly 1 cent a gallon maintained over a year, is going to cost the American consumer right about $1 billion of basically a consumption tax onto gas. So 40 to 80 cents is equivalent to another 40 to 80 billion, which is not peanuts when you put that not only with your house budget and with the transportation costs around the country, but also with the total economy. Sorry, Gene, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was I think that's a good point, and it's just the problem with the economy, I mean, other than what we've mentioned over and over, is what you say right there. There's just so many areas of normal daily expenses that people are just getting squeezed and squeezed, whether it's health care or college or the cost of gas or et cetera, and housing, although, you know, housing, of course, is a lot cheaper than it used to be. And, you know, you throw those all in there, and it's really hard for people to have any kind of extra money, let alone money to put food on the table. And that's basically what's wrong with the economy.
As Jake pointed out, one of those things that are affecting everybody's pocketbook is the price of gasoline. Of course, BP just concluded a major deal to settle on their spill in the Gulf, and a lot of that still hasn't been resolved, including the environmental damages, has it, Gene?
No, they actually haven't even touched on that, and it's kind of an interesting subject because of where it occurred and out in the middle of the Gulf. And read a little bit from it, but BP settlement with plaintiffs suing the company over the 2010 oil spill disaster in the Gulf of Mexico may address harm to individuals and businesses, but there's nothing in it that compensates the public for damage to its natural resources and the environment. That's from the Justice Department. That's a potentially crucial issue because a separate victims claims fund that was set up months after the Deepwater Horizon rig explosion was also meant to cover environmental damages, but it's now expected to be used to cover the BP settlement with plaintiffs. BP said it expects to pay out $7.8 billion in settlement with the plaintiffs, and that was announced last Friday. The Justice Department noted that the settlement doesn't address significant damages to natural resources and the environment. While we are pleased that BP may be stepping up to address harms to individual plaintiffs, this by no means fully addresses its responsibility for the harms it has caused. That's generally. David Ullman, a University of Michigan Law School professor who previously served as chief of the Justice Department's Environmental Crime Section, estimates that a deal between BP, the federal government, and the states, one that includes criminal and civil penalties and resolves natural resource damage claims, would be worth between $20 to $25 billion. BP still has to resolve claims by the U.S. government, Gulf states, and its partners on the doomed Deepwater Horizon rig, which exploded and sank 50 miles off Louisiana after a BP oil well a mile below the ocean surface blew out. So they haven't resolved those claims yet. BP anticipates that the separate claims fund run by Ken Feinberg will seize at some point. I think that started with $20 billion. It says it expects money from the fund will be used to pay the settlement. According to the Deepwater Horizon Oil Spill Trust, current total trust assets are approximately $9.5 billion. So this is a really interesting aspect to the disaster. Because for one thing, it's extremely hard, like the Exxon Valdez incident, it's extremely hard to estimate the actual damages. And it's and then, of course, the property issue, you know, it is considered property, I believe, of the federal government. Still, it just brings a lot of things into view, and it's kind of going to be interesting how it settles out. I'm sure it'll probably be years before it actually does settle out.
Yep, I'm sure that's true. We've got about a minute left. I just wanted to touch a little bit on something that I mentioned earlier during the headlines segment. This is from the Associated Press. I'm just going to read from it. The shadowy underworld of Internet hackers was rocked this Tuesday by news that one of the world's most wanted and most feared computer vandals has been an FBI informant for months and helped authorities build a case against five people they say were comrades. The FBI said it captured the legendary hacker known as Sabu last June, and he turned out to be Hector Xavier Monsieur, a 28-year-old self-taught unemployed computer programmer with no college education, living on welfare and public housing in New York. His exploits made him a hero to some in cyberspace until he made a rookie mistake. he posted something online without cloaking his IP address or computer identity, and someone tipped off the FBI. And soon after his arrest, he pleaded guilty and began spilling secrets. Well, the gist of it is, when all is said and done, is it led to the arrest of at least five people so far. It has basically ripped out the heart of so-called LulzSec, which is one of the major groups within the Anonymous movement. And we talked about this a couple weeks ago, how the FBI had more resources than Anonymous. We could be seeing the end of Anonymous here. Well, unfortunately, we've reached the end of the hour, but Jake and Gene, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Same here.
And we will see you, we will see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
See you.